This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. What is the value of life? It sounds like a rhetorical question, but it's one that Ken Feinberg has had to answer for years. In the aftermath of 9/11, the Bush administration appointed Feinberg to head the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund. And about that experience, Feinberg wrote, "I was asked to play Solomon, to be both judge and jury, and calculating appropriate compensation in each individual case. But how do you presume to put a dollar value on a life that ends prematurely? How do you calculate a victim's pain and a survivor's emotional distress? It is a near impossible task." Since 9/11, Ken Feinberg has navigated other tragedies, from the Virginia Tech massacre to the BP oil spill, and he details these events in his latest book, Who Gets What? Kenneth Feinberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be on.
So I want to start with 9/11, since we're coming up on the anniversary here. And you say in your book, Who Gets What, that you're still haunted. You spent 33 months, so a long time, as the special master of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. You paid out more than $7 billion to over 5,000 claimants. When you say you're still haunted, in what way does September 11th manifest itself in your daily life?
We agreed at the time to give any individual who lost a loved one on 9/11 or any individual who was physically injured with burns or broken bones, we gave that individual the right voluntarily, if he or she wanted, to come and see me and to explain officially on the record anything they wanted to say about that lost loved one or that injury. I conducted over 900 individual hearings, and the stories I heard and the horror of that day resonates with me over a decade later. And I'll never forget those families that came to see me in grief, angry, frustrated, sobbing. It was a wrenching experience. Now, it had to be done. I think it was largely the reason the fund was so successful. 97% of the families came to see me.
Wow.
But or agreed to participate in the program. But it haunts me to this day, some of the stories I heard.
Now, did you feel like you had become in some way a therapist, that they were coming partially to get compensation, but partially also to have somebody hear them? Obviously, there were so many stories that even for the media, it was hard to cover them all. So were you the person who could hear every story?
Yes. And it was the latter. When you say, was it partially the reason? It was 99% of the reason.
Yeah.
Very few families came to see me to talk about money.
Right.
They came to validate the memory of a lost loved one,
mm-hmm.
or to express frustration and emotional outrage at how life had thrown them and their loved one a curveball. That's why people came to see me.
And you have some really, you know, as you said, you have some incredible stories, and some are stories that themselves have such a curveball that you can't possibly see them coming. I'm going to read a little bit from your book, and you talk to a woman who explains to you that she lost her husband at the World Trade Center, and here's your sort of paraphrase of what she says to you. "Mr. Feinberg, my husband was Mr. Mom. Every day that he was not at the office, he was home, teaching our 6-year-old how to play baseball, teaching our 4-year-old how to read, reading a bedtime story to our 2-year-old, and what a chef. He was also the gardener mowing the lawn. He was Mr. Mom. The only reason I'm still on this earth and have not joined him in heaven is because of our 3 children. He would want me to stay here because of the children." Okay, and so then the woman leaves your office, and the next day you get this telephone call from a lawyer in New York who says this to you. "Mr. Feinberg, did you meet yesterday with a woman with 3 children who lost her husband at the World Trade Center? I don't want to complicate your life. You have a very difficult job, but she doesn't know that her husband had 2 other children with his girlfriend in the Bronx. I represent the girlfriend. When you issue your 9/11 fund check, there are not 3 surviving children, but rather 5 children. I would be able to provide paternity. I'm sure you'll do the right thing." What do you do when you have, obviously, grief and in such unexpected ways thrown at you?
Well, that's the problem, you see. You don't anticipate these situations. And when they come at you at a hearing and you're totally unprepared to hear these stories, you listen, you try and empathize, but like in that one that you just summarized, I mean, obviously I decided not to tell the widow
right
about these other two children or the boyfriend or the girlfriend in Queens. I'm sure by now she must know over a decade later, but I really didn't think it was my place. My job, established by Congress and delegated to me by the Attorney General and President Bush, was to evaluate claims and get money out the door fast. And that's what we did. And I tried as best I could to avoid all these side issues involving family and family counseling, et cetera.
Now, I wonder, in terms of sort of having this job and dealing with what you were hearing, how much, while you were going through this, you questioned your ability to stay with this case all the way through the 33 months that it took to disperse you're talking billions of dollars, $7 billion to these people.
That's right. I mean, you stay the course. When I've often said that what I did on 9/11 was not rocket science. There are millions of Americans, I think, that could have done what I did in designing and administering this program. Congress passed the law. When the president and the attorney general ask you to do this, and to do it quickly, and to do it effectively, you don't say no. And it was a traumatic experience, I must say, dealing with all of this death and unanticipated tragedy. But you do it as an American citizen, what others would do, similar to what people are doing every day in Afghanistan or Iraq, risking their lives. And I just think, as a public citizen, and being asked by the president, the attorney general, this is something you have to do.
And one of the toughest questions sort of posed to you here was, there were a lot of people who died in the World Trade Center who made a lot of money every year. They were sort of Wall Street financial types, and they made hundreds of thousands of dollars every year. There were also people who died who didn't make very much at all. They worked in kitchens. They worked as janitors. Did you end up giving a lot more money to the families of the people that had the financial earners in them versus, let's say, the families of the janitors that just didn't make very much money?
Of course. The law required me to do so. Don't forget, the law passed by Congress said we want to discourage victims from suing. We don't want lawsuits brought against the airlines or the World Trade Center or Massport or the Port Authority of New York or Boeing Aircraft or the security guard companies. We don't want lawsuits. But the program is voluntary, so make sure that everybody gets a different amount of money so that they will individually agree, I'll take this money and I won't sue. Now, that meant, as you point out, that the family of the stockbroker or the banker who died at the World Trade Center must get more than the busboy, the waiter, the fireman, the cop, the soldier.
Was there pushback on that to say,
of course there was pushback.
I mean, how is a janitor's life worth less than a stockbroker's life?
That I heard that constantly. Mm-hmm. It was very, very emotionally divisive. Mr. Feinberg, I lost my husband. He was a fireman, and he died a hero at the World Trade Center. Why are you giving me $2 million less than the banker's widow who worked for Enron, working in the World Trade Center?
Mm-hmm.
Am I missing something here? Now, I tried to explain that they were missing a great deal, but I think my explanation largely was hollow and fell on deaf ears, and it was very, very emotional that the government would be using taxpayer money, total taxpayer money here in this program on 9/11, to pay a banker, the surviving banker's family, much more than the surviving fireman's family. And that did not sit well with the firemen or the policemen or others who were in the who received less money.
Now, you met with people who cut across, as we were talking about just now, many social strata. So people who are making $300,000-$400,000 a year, people who are making $100,000 a year, people making $50,000 a year, and probably people who are washing dishes who are making $18,000 a year. And I wonder if you learned anything about the way that the people at these different social strata approach money.
No.
Or no. It was similar.
No, I'm asked that all the time. Is there a reaction about compensation different from the banker and the stockbroker than the waiter and the busboy? Not really.
Mm-hmm.
The amounts may differ, but the reaction of people in grief is basically the same. And it is, Mr. Feinberg, I just lost a loved one, and you're here to talk to me about money? Bring my loved one back. That's what I want.
Mm-hmm.
This money is a very poor substitute for my grieving due to a terrible loss. And it didn't matter whether you were whether a waiter died or a fireman died or a stockbroker died.
Mm-hmm.
The emotional response almost invariably had nothing to do about money.
Let me take you back for a minute. I bet almost everybody listening, I certainly can remember where they were, what they were doing on September 11th. It's one of those things that stays in your mind. I'm going to play a little clip of Tom Brokaw hosting special news coverage on September 11th, 2001, and then Quentin Feinberg will come back to you, and I want to hear where you were on September 11th. Let's listen.
Not since Pearl Harbor was attacked on December 7th, 1941, has this country undergone such a devastating and damaging attack. And it may not yet be over. We do know at this time that at least four targets have been attacked. The two Twin Trade Tower centers here in New York City, the Pentagon, and then another plane that was crashed deliberately into an area outside of Pittsburgh. That is the second plane hitting the Twin Trade Towers this morning. All of them hijacked airliners. Then these two colossal icons of the American capitalist system collapsed in Lower Manhattan. The death toll at this hour is unknown, but it is expected to be, as Mayor Giuliani has said, horrendous.
Ken Feinberg, do you remember where you were on the morning of September 11th?
I had just finished teaching a law school class at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And when I was walking out of the class at the student union, the TV was on, the television, and the students were watching in disbelief these large photos, live photos of the World Trade Center. I got on a train at the 30th Street Station to return to my office in Washington. And when we got to Wilmington, Delaware, the plane that hit the Pentagon resulted in all rail traffic south of Philadelphia to Washington being shut down.
Hmm.
A few of us left the train. We hailed a taxi, and the taxi cab drove us the 90 miles back to Washington.
Hmm. I want to ask you, finally, about September 11th, how did you go from that morning at the University of Pennsylvania, as you describe, to being the person that was chosen by John Ashcroft, by President George W. Bush, as the special master of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund? How did that happen?
I had read in the newspaper after 9/11 that a special fund was being created. I had, in the past, worked on special compensation like Agent Orange for Vietnam veterans and resolving thousands of asbestos personal injury claims. So I called my friend Chuck Hagel, Senator Hagel, from Republican from Nebraska, and my old boss, Senator Kennedy, and told them I had read about this new program and could I be of any help. Well, Hagel immediately contacted the Attorney General and the President and said, This is the guy. This is the man who knows this stuff and can design and administer this compensation program passed by Congress. And I interviewed with the Attorney General a couple of times, and within a matter of weeks, he asked me to design and administer the program, which I did.
I want to talk a little bit more about that past that you had in dividing up compensation, and then the future, which of course included Deepwater Horizon. We are talking about what it means to put a price tag on human tragedy. My guest is lawyer Ken Feinberg. This issue is the subject of his latest book, Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. I'm Kara Miller, and the conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. And if you're just tuning in, my guest is lawyer Ken Feinberg. In response to 9/11, the Bush administration appointed him to oversee the compensation fund for the victims. And since then, he's been involved in other huge tragedies, like the Virginia Tech massacre and the wreckage brought by Wall Street and the BP oil spill. And he details what it is like to work through these events in his latest book, Who Gets What? And Ken Feinberg, you mentioned right before the break when you were talking about how you became the head of the compensation fund on September 11th, you mentioned Senator Kennedy. And so I want to take you back a little bit. You talk about growing up and the Kennedys, specifically John F. Kennedy, being a real inspiration for you. Here you were a kid in Brockton, Massachusetts. Talk for a minute about the Kennedys' role in your life before you even met Senator Ted Kennedy, and then we'll get to that.
Young people today, I think, fail to fully appreciate the impact of President Kennedy on the country. I was a young teenager in Brockton, public schools.
Right.
And the notion of President Kennedy, this young president, calling on Americans to help the nation and work in the public interest and promote national unity, that government was not the enemy, that government could be a force for good, and public service was important. All of that resonated back then. And I was in Brockton and deeply influenced by that call for service and the call to help your fellow Americans. And it sounds maybe cliche today, but at the time, it had a real impact on me and an impact that lasted throughout my professional life.
And then you became part of Senator Ted Kennedy's network, and you talk about that network really interestingly, which I didn't realize Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer is a real part of that network, as being a sort of, once you're part of it, you're a lifelong member of it.
That's right. Senator Kennedy was an extraordinary public servant. I think it's fair to say that Senator Kennedy will stand in American history as one of the handful of most effective senators in the history of our nation. And he was very proactive in helping his Massachusetts constituents. And even though you might work for a period of time for Senator Kennedy and then leave and move on to other professional goals and endeavors, he never let you forget that you were part of his network. And on frequent occasions, I would get a call in my private law practice completely out of the blue. And he'd be calling saying, I need your help on something, or a constituent needs your assistance, or will you talk to this constituent or provide some guidance? And this whole ex-Kennedy staffer network, including Justice Breyer, remained very, very close to Senator Kennedy right up until his death.
And you say that, you know, when you were working with the September 11th Compensation Fund, that he asked you for a list of the Massachusetts residents who were killed in the World Trade Center. Why did he want that list?
It's an incredible story. Senator Kennedy called me and said, Ken, you're doling out this compensation to all the families. Well, don't forget, those planes, some of them left from Logan Airport with Boston, with Massachusetts constituents on board. I want the name and contact information for every single death claim and physical injury claim arising out of 9/11 involving Massachusetts constituents. And Senator Kennedy then either telephoned or met with every single representative of the dead and the injured. He felt that that was an obligation, that he wanted to do it, and he then proceeded to contact every family.
Yeah, and the interesting thing was, it sounds like that was really not out of character for him, that he would, if he knew a wife of a friend was sick, he'd try to get her moved to a better hospital. I mean, he was sort of always maneuvering behind the scenes to help out the people who were his constituents or that he particularly cared about or that his friends, you know, and that he was sort of always keeping an eye on all sorts of things at the same time.
I think you're absolutely right. People sometimes forget Senator Kennedy served in the U.S. Senate for something like well over 40 years. And he knew everybody in government. You see, he had been around so long. And although he had this reputation for being very, you know, involved in very liberal causes in Washington and fighting tooth and nail with on different issues, people sometimes forget how effective he was in assisting his own constituents, not only individuals who had a problem with Social Security or the Veterans Administration or unemployment compensation or immigration, but also there were corporations and very visible public companies in Massachusetts who to this day praise Senator Kennedy for all he did for them in helping them with problems that they might have at the Justice Department or at the Department of Commerce or with regulatory agencies. He was the most effective server of his constituents of, I think, any senator in American history.
I like the anecdote, too, of having people over to his house, including a lot of Republican senators who were his friends, and singing. And he would sing Irish ballads and Broadway show tunes, and you say it was generally pretty off-key. I mean,
that's right.
Yeah.
If you attended his receptions and his dinners at his home, you would find that time and again, senior Republicans in the Senate, Ted Stevens, Orrin Hatch, Chuck Hagel, other Republicans who might not think the way Senator Kennedy did on the politics, but it was a noble profession, and he was friends with these people. And they would come to his home gladly and had only praise for Senator Kennedy. And they tried to work together, which you don't see enough of today in the U.S. Senate or in the Congress.
Right. I want to take you back to one of your very first experiences figuring out how to divide a settlement. And we talked before the break about are there people at different social strata who see money differently? And you said, no, I don't really think people see money that differently. I wonder if over time you see people looking at money differently. So this case was 1984 when Vietnam veterans got a settlement at the time, a very large settlement, $180 million from the companies that had made Agent Orange for the government, including Dow Chemical and Monsanto. How did you get chosen for this? And do you see any difference between the way that people behaved with this kind of settlement in 1984 versus what you've seen more recently?
No, I was chosen in 1984 because the federal judge who was overseeing the Agent Orange litigation in Brooklyn, Judge Jack B. Weinstein, I had known Judge Weinstein for many, many years. We had worked together at different times for the chief judge of New York State. And so when Judge Weinstein had that case, he called me and asked if I would get involved to try and settle the case. And we settled it in about 8 weeks for $180 million, which was unheard of at the time. But the Vietnam veterans community was a very tight-knit community at the time. People forget how difficult it was if you were a Vietnam veteran in a very unpopular war to return home. and expect gratitude. Vietnam veterans were maligned. They were criticized. They were the visible presence of American military might in a very unpopular war. And when we settled that case, it was very heart-wrenching, but very warm and very encouraging to learn that most Vietnam veterans wanted the money distributed, not to themselves. They didn't want the money. Most Vietnam veterans said, let's give the money to our brethren, our fellow soldiers, our brothers who served with us in Vietnam and are now physically injured, the most damaged physically by the war, by Agent Orange, the herbicide. And almost unanimously, the Vietnam veterans community rallied around the notion, which we adopted, of distributing the money based on need rather than on any other factor.
No, but that doesn't feel different to you than the way that the victims of September 11th responded and how they wanted money divided.
Well, first of all, remember, the Vietnam veteran community was a very self-contained unit. This was a group of hundreds of thousands of Vietnam veterans that had been through sheer hell, both over in Vietnam and when they returned to the United States. So I think that was sort of a self-defined unit.
Mm-hmm.
The 9/11 victims, for the most part, the only time they expressed outrage about the money was not so much what were they going to get, but they contrasted what they were getting versus their next-door neighbor. Everybody counts other people's money, you see. It is human nature. Mr. Feinberg, you're giving me $1 million. Well, all right, I thank you. But let me ask you, why is my next-door neighbor getting $2 million? Why are you maligning the memory of my dead wife,
mm-hmm.
or my dead husband, or my dead brother or sister or child? That was a real problem. When Congress decided that everybody should get a different amount of money in order to discourage people from litigating, invariably, you are going to get this contrast in argument. The dollars in absolute terms were very generous. The average award that I rendered in 9/11 was $2 million tax-free per case. The problem was, well, in absolute terms, you're giving me $2 million, but in relative terms, my next-door neighbor's getting $3 million. How dare you? Mr. Feinberg, what do you have against my dead wife? You didn't even know her, and yet you're giving me $1 million less than my next-door neighbor. How dare you? And this was the emotional problem you had to confront.
We're talking to Kenneth Feinberg, former special master of the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund and author of Who Gets What? And you mention in the book that not every culture necessarily is as focused on money as we are. There might be cultures in which people don't necessarily want money. They want something else. They want an apology. They want an admittance of guilt. Do you think that, have you seen sort of cultural differences either within America or between America and other countries in terms of the weight that we put on, you know, I got $1.2 million, but that guy got 1.4. What's going on here?
Well, it's been since the founding of the Republic here in the United States, capitalism. Dollars have always been the measure of loss. That's the way it has been since George Washington, and it was our first president. When you have a capitalist society that is driven by the free market, dollars become a very poor but necessary surrogate for damage, loss, pain. That's the way it is. Now, there are some countries where loss is not measured in dollars, but might be measured in apology, a promise to work for the injured victim until that victim is made whole. I remember in South Africa, there was, after apartheid ended, there was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Right.
Where in return for immunity from lawsuits, people came in and voiced their apology or their anger. those who were responsible for or benefited from apartheid. So there are various ways, very creative ways, that you might deal with the problem of innocent victimhood. But in the United States, it's always been, I'm innocent and you owe me X dollars. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of the surrogate or the great leveler for determining loss.
Let me take you to another situation. In 2010, April of 2010, the Deepwater Horizon explosion in the Gulf. And this was a compensation fund that had maybe a little bit of a rockier struggle than September 11th. And to sort of set the scene here, I'm going to play a clip from 60 Minutes. This is from August of 2010. And one of the crew members of the Deepwater Horizon is describing life on the rig in the very last moments before it exploded.
These are 3-inch thick steel fire rated doors with 6 stainless steel hinges supporting them on the frame. As I reached for the handle, I heard this awful hissing noise, this whoosh, and at the height of the hiss, a huge explosion. The explosion literally rips the door from the hinges, impacts me and takes me to the other side of the shop. And I'm up against the wall when I finally come around with a door on top of me. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, this is it. I'm going to die right here.
Ken Feinberg, you say this was a really hard situation because there was no patriotic surge. There was no clear enemy. You've got over 200 millions of gallons of oil spilling into the Gulf. But it wasn't anything like September 11th or Virginia Tech or some of the other tragedies you've been involved with. How did this feel different to you?
Well, it was different in a number of respects. You've mentioned one very important respect. This was an international, well-heeled, well-known oil company.
Right.
That had acknowledged responsibility for the explosion. This wasn't some foreign, you know, attack by a foreign power or by Al-Qaeda. This was an oil company that left the White House after meeting with President Obama and agreed to front $20 billion to pay claims. And President Obama and BP agreed that I should do this. So I was confronted, unlike 9/11, with a targeted defendant responsible for this. And I received in 18 months over 1 million claims from 50 states and 35 foreign countries from people all claiming they were injured as a result of the oil spill.
Yeah, it's tough because in September 11th, you had a certain number of deaths. In this case, you had 11 deaths, but mostly businesses that had been ruined, hotels where people weren't staying anymore. And I imagine it got incredibly difficult to try to figure out who really deserved compensation and who was just too many steps removed from an oil spill to get any compensation.
That's right. There were two problems. Problem number one, how many steps removed? What do you tell a dentist in New Orleans who says, you know, I lost 50% of my patients because the fishermen couldn't afford to come to the dentist, pay me, or a veterinarian who says, you know, tourists come down here to the Gulf and they leave their dogs and cats with me. Well, the tourists aren't coming to the hotels because of the oil spill and I've lost all these dog and cat patients. Pay me. Or a chiropractor. Pay me. Or a restaurant in the north end of Boston that says, you know, I can't make shrimp scampi because I can't get shrimp from the Gulf. I've lost 12% of my clientele. Pay me. So one problem, as you point out, was eligibility. The other problem, even just as pronounced and just as difficult, problems of proof. Mr. Feinberg, I'm a fisherman in the Gulf and I lost $50,000 because I couldn't fish. Well, that may be, but show me, do you have tax returns? How do I know you lost $50,000? Oh, trust me. We do things with a handshake down here, Mr. Feinberg, not like up north. And we don't have any tax returns. We don't have any documentation. I lost $50,000. That's what I just lost. And just trust me. I'm just telling you, I lost 50. Pay me, pay me, pay me, pay me. Well, I wasn't going to pay anybody who couldn't prove what they would, the extent and scope of their damage. So problems of eligibility and problems of proof led to a very, as you say, a very emotional experience in making this program work.
And you went to these town meetings on the Gulf in different states, and people got really angry at you. Not only people in the town, but also Senator David Vitter of Louisiana and other politicians also used you sort of as a little bit of a lightning rod. So when people got really angry at you, did you ever think to yourself, there's a cultural difference here that I cannot bridge? You know, here I am, this Northeastern lawyer, and they just are not relating to me.
Well, you hear that, and you do think that. I'm not sure it's any different if there was an oil spill outside of Boston or Maine or California. I'm not sure that there is a cultural difference in honoring your obligations as a taxpayer. I'm not sure that you would single out the Gulf for any special, label them any different. I don't know.
But you didn't.
But I do know this.
Mm-hmm.
I said to myself, the integrity of this program, I will not pay people who cannot document the scope of their damage. That is not too much to ask. I took a lot of heat from elected officials who saw this as a freebie to go after this, you know, Northeastern Kennedy guy, and that's fine. I realize that. President Obama stuck by me, the Attorney General stuck by me, and basically the elected officials in the Gulf, Mary Landrieu, Governor Haley Barbour, Governor Thad Cochran of Mississippi, they were all pretty good, actually. There were a few examples, but overall, I knew this would happen.
And how did you feel like this ended up, this sort of wrapped up the BP oil spill? Because one of the other things people really jumped on you for was taking payment. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that in many of the other compensation funds you worked in, you've done pro bono work.
That's right.
But this time you didn't. You had a monthly retainer for your law firm, and that came under a lot of scrutiny. How do you feel like you left the Gulf experience?
Oh, I at the end of the day, just think about it. The BP oil spill fund, by all accounts, really, was a success. In 18 months, before the first trial was even scheduled to begin, we distributed $6.5 billion in the Gulf. We paid 220,000 people and businesses. A perfect example of an alternative to the system where you hire a lawyer and you file a lawsuit and you wait and wait and wait. And frankly, the judge in the litigation did a fabulous job in moving forward on an expeditious way and even scheduling the first trial. So I think the oil spill fund, it worked. There are not many claims left to litigate, but no question, it raises profound issues about whether or not we ought to set up these special funds for special people.
And what do you think about the way that BP ended up settling this? I mean, a lot of people thought when they came out of the White House after this meeting with President Obama and they said, we'll put up $20 billion for a fund. Wow. But people also didn't have a sense of the extent of the damage. How do you feel like BP and the other companies that were part of this, Halliburton, Transocean, how do you feel like they sort of made out at the end? Did they pay what they should have?
Well, remember, BP is the only one that put up the $20 billion. Halliburton and Transocean and others had nothing to do with this fund. This was simply BP that did this. I think BP analyzed the options. Do we want to litigate like Exxon Valdez up in Alaska for 20 years? They're still litigating, still to this day. Or do we want to get this behind us, acknowledge our problem, acknowledge our responsibility, pay the claims, and move on? And I think that BP wisely made a business decision. Look, let's get on beyond this. Maybe it's Transocean's fault or Halliburton's fault. We'll sue them separately. But in terms of innocent victims, let's pay the claims and move on. And I think that's just what they did. And I think that the program, as I say, largely succeeded in accelerating the payment of these claims.
We've talked about you dealing with Agent Orange in litigation, about September 11th, Deepwater Horizon. And I wonder, there's obviously, you probably more than most other lawyers and most anybody in any profession deal with tragedy and have to face tragedy more than anybody. How do you balance that in your life? And how do you sort of stay out of the mire of that kind of tragedy?
You can't.
Okay.
It can't help but affect you. Unless you have a heart of stone, it's going to affect you. But you got to realize that in all of these, first of all, these tragedies, thank goodness, they don't come around every day. Agent Orange, Virginia Tech, 9/11, BP, those are four examples, but over a almost 30-year period. So it's not as if I'm enmeshed in this day in and day out, 365 days a year. Fortunately, these programs are rather wide and divergent. But it can't help but affect you. You take solace in the fact that public officials, from presidents to attorneys general to judges, are asking you to perform this public service. So you do it.
Right.
Like millions of Americans would if they were asked. You do it. And you try as best you can to do it in a professional way, reinforced by the notion that you're trying to do the right thing and that you expect people in grief to be emotionally critical, to be angry, to be frustrated, to be disappointed. It goes with the territory, and you just try and keep a balance, a sense of emotional balance, but it is very, very difficult to do that.
Now, are there antidotes that you use in your life? I know, for example, you're a big opera buff. So what is the role of opera and anything else in your life that sort of takes you out of the tragedy and gives you something really spectacular to focus on?
Thank goodness for opera and classical music. At night, when you're pacing and you're wondering and you're frustrated and you're troubled by what you've done that day, you just try and lose yourself a little bit with the height of civilization. You try and immerse yourself in Mozart or Beethoven or Mahler or Verdi or Wagner and listen to opera. You just try and distance yourself from the emotionalism of that day and the next day, and that helps. And then, of course, it sounds sort of trite, but if you have a loving family, a wife and children who understand what you're going through and reinforce their love and their support for tough decisions. Don't poo-poo that. That can be a pretty valuable crutch, emotional crutch, in getting through these tough problems.
We've been talking about what it means and what it takes to put a monetary value on tragedy. I've been speaking with lawyer Ken Feinberg. His latest book is Who Gets What? Ken Feinberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Callie Crossley is back in Studio 3.
Kara, well, you were talking to Ken Feinberg, who had to handle the wreckage wrought by Wall Street. Well, we're going to look at how Wall Street is faring 4 years after the big bailout with Marketplace's Heidi Moore.
Interesting. I will be listening to what she has to say. I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio.